Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is the first time we've tried Stage Door Johnny live with the music from the podcast.
Yeah, I came last time 2 weeks ago.
Oh, look at this. We're all off with some audience interaction. This is fantastic. I love that you feel this is a free and open forum. Let's keep it going. Which the music feels very appropriate for this evening's guest. Hello and welcome to Stage Door Johnny live at the beautiful German Street Theatre. You're so lovely to come out. Anybody who doesn't know, Stage Door Johnny is the podcast about theatre and life in the theatre. That's my tagline, and I'm sticking with it. But tonight, it is about theatre and life in the theatre, and life in the concert hall, and life in the recording studio, and life in the thousands of rooms, spending the thousands of hours practising the trumpet. So my guests tonight, I have the incredible privilege 2 weeks ago in this beautiful theatre, interviewing who Vogue magazine called the hottest power couple in theatre, Jez Butterworth and Laura Donnelly, the great playwright of Jerusalem, and his leading lady in life and art, Laura Donnelly. Well, I see you, one hottest power couple in theatre, and I raise you, one hottest power couple in British culture, because tonight's guests are just extraordinary. He is a three-time, I've got to get this right because it's a lot of maths. He is a three-time Olivier Award-winning director. He's a double Tony winner. He decided not to just confine himself to theatre. He's won four BAFTAs, three Golden Globes. He's won the Oscar for his first ever movie, decided to direct a movie. And thought, oh, yeah, this is, doesn't seem terribly difficult. I'll just win the Best Director Oscar for my first film. And my other guest is one of our greatest musicians. She's one of the greatest classical and jazz trumpeters on the planet. She is, I need to get this right too, she is a three-time Brit Award winner. She is a three-time Echo Classique Award winner. That was not something I was familiar with before I started researching. She's a Gramophone Artist of the Year winner. She has collaborated with Stevie Wonder. She's collaborated with Elton John. She's played the Hollywood Bowl and the Last Night of the Proms. She is the great trumpeter, Alison Balsam. And it turns out Sam Mendes and Alison Balsam are in fact married to each other. Who knew? This is extraordinary news. So to talk about their life in the theatre and in art and in life and in the concert hall and every other space you can imagine, here are the great Sam Mendes and Alison Balsam.
I didn't tell the story.
I was going to tell the story. For full disclosure, which is what, of course, Stage Door Johnny has become a byword for frankness and openness, I should say that Sam and I have known each other a while. We met 37 years ago at Cambridge University when Sam was doing a production of Rostand's Cyrano de Bergerac. We have stayed friends ever since. In fact, I sort of want to say that I was the first Lady Mendes before Alison came along. I think there's no bitterness between us. I think Alison has done a terrific job being Lady Mendes. But for a significant number of years, I was Sam's plus one. to many glamorous events around the world, including, do you remember, we were sitting in a cafe in Primrose Hill in 1999, and you said to me, what are you doing for New Year? And it was quite a big New Year that year. And I said, I don't know why. He said, do you want to come to Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman's yacht in Sydney Harbour for Millennium New Year? I said, I'll check my availability. And we went and we found ourselves playing pool on Tom Cruise's pool table in Tom Cruise's house when he was still married to Nicole Kidman in Sydney. And you were busy sort of clearing the balls. It was before American Beauty had come out, but Tom had seen a cut of it. And he said, turned to me and he said, I seen Sam's movie. He said, I think it's a masterpiece. I hadn't seen it. I said, felt slightly bitter about it. I said, that's what I hear. I said, I think Sam is going to be knighted one day. And he said, you're kidding me. He said, get out of here. He said, so what would he be called? What would I have to call him when he's knighted? We lived in Primrose Hill at the time. He said, would he be Sir Sam of Primrose? That's good. So part of me always thinks of you as Sir Sam of Primrose. Sir Sam of Primrose, Alison Bolton of somewhere else.
I'll take Primrose.
Primrose, yeah, Primrose. You guys had these extraordinary beginnings to which I've just alluded. You were both prodigies. Do you think that's fair to say? I mean, you had this extraordinary success, extraordinarily young. Sam, you, within 2.5 years of your first job in the theatre, this is well documented, but I'll say it again, literally from sweeping the stage at Chichester Festival Theatre, within 2.5 years, you had 2 shows running concurrently in the West End, one of them starring Judi Dench, Cherry Orchard. Alison, you were a finalist in Young Musician of the Year. You became a soloist incredibly young. You got album deals incredibly young. So my question is, I suppose, do you miss that person? Is there anything about her that you miss?
I think actually with Sam and me, we both from different, you know, different experiences. But when you just said you met 37 years ago, I started playing the trumpet at that exact time.
Really?
Yeah, so when you met, I started the trumpet. I wasn't immediately a proficient in the trumpet. I loved it. But I think it was my teenage years having amazing teachers and amazing experiences that I really sort of found my feet and sort of my cruising altitude. But not really till I went to music college, went to the Guildhall. And I think you probably have a similar feeling that you didn't really find your sweet spot where you just knew exactly what you wanted to do till you were a little, well, till you were at university.
Yeah, I mean, I think the difference is that Ali had a sort of, I feel you had a calling, which is different. You know, I think that even though you knew you still had to work at it, you had this gift when you were how old? 10, 9? And you were working at it in your own way, gently, and finding out about yourself and the relationship between yourself and the instrument from a child, which is different for me. Because when I was a child, I was mostly lost. You know, I wasn't very good at school. And now I think we agree I was basically ADHD, although, you know, it's only since our children have gone down that path that I've realized that. And so I came to it much later and it happened much faster, but I was a slightly more formed person. I mean, it was university. I didn't even go to university planning to direct. I remember walking around the freshers, you know, fair where they lay out all the stools, all the different things you can do at university, and scoffing at the acting stalls and thinking, poor buggers, you know, God, I wouldn't want to be an actor, you know. No. I want to go. And I went straight to all the journalism stalls. I went to, you know, Stop Press. You remember that, university newspaper, and that's what I wanted to do. I was convinced it was something to do with writing. So it was later for me. And I also think the purity of the relationship that Ali has, which I envy, of her and her instrument and her craft, very specific, that's difficult to get your hands around as a director, because it's such a complicated process and involves so many different other people. So for me, it was more of a dance, I think. I always felt like the beginning success, however you determine that, like having 2 shows in the West End, was as much to do with other people's trust as it was to do with my own skill set. I don't think I really knew what I was doing for quite a long time. I think I was just very good at convincing other people that I was, which is a slightly different thing.
Did it feel like a calling? to you as
it did feel like a calling, but it was also, again, like a very precarious profession. I remember it was only after I played at the last night of the Proms as a soloist. So, of course, I'd done a few concerts before that point. And that was the first time after that concert that I didn't feel embarrassed to say, you know, if you were filling in a mortgage form, like a soloist, say the word soloist without feeling like I was sort of just wishing I was a soloist. It's like, well, I guess I can say I actually am a soloist now, because I felt, you know, a lot of freelance musicians often feel like they're only as good as their last gig. And I felt like, well, I've done that one now, so everything else will hopefully feel like, yeah, it's going to be okay.
It took until 2009 for you to really feel that validated?
I was already a full-time soloist, but right. It's just that sense that, okay, that went well, but next week I'm doing something else and it's really difficult and it might not go well. It's a brilliant profession in some ways because it's a real meritocracy. It's really not about the trumpet or your gender or age or, you know, your looks or the, it's very much about what you've got to say on stage. And that just happens to be your vehicle. I didn't know that I'd have a consistent, you know, toolkit that I could rely on if the chips were down. It's like, could I still do it? Because, you know, sometimes we have those amazing performances where everything just comes together and, you know, it's magic. But once it becomes your profession, your worst performance has to have that in it. And I think once that becomes consistent, it's like, oh, yeah, I think I can sort of do this. So.
But my question was a little bit, do you miss that? Is there anything about that young person, if you can possibly recall them, who was struggling, fighting? You described it, Ali, I think, in one interview as like a street fight to become a soloist.
Oh, yeah, well, I guess that was more about my ambition to have a career, to create a career, because there isn't really a job called a classical trumpet soloist. So I had to sort of make that job in my own, with my own sort of taste and interest in music. But I don't miss that, actually. But I do miss that feeling when you meet an inspiring teacher or an inspirational artist, when you realise you've reached a level and you think you can do something, but then they open the door to the whole next level, and you feel it as you get better.
Who was that for you? Who opened those doors to the next level?
I mean, no one that...
We don't care. Describe them.
Yeah, I mean, I had this incredible teacher who, even now, if anyone's ever seen the old Karate Kid, Mr. Miyagi. So the rest of my friends and my trumpet colleagues were playing really fast and high and loud and impressive stuff, but my teacher had me just playing middle C, and I might progress to like page 7 of the big method book, but was just wax on, wax off.
Right.
For, you know, most of those 7 years I learned with him between the ages of 13 and 20. I sort of owe everything to that teacher, because a lot of people would say, oh, I'm not really sure what it is that we're learning with that particular person, but I could feel it. And sometimes the doors would open and I'd feel myself, you know, like on Snakes and Ladders, when you get the ladder. That's an amazing feeling. And I think I'm still looking for that. I think we're always looking for that, aren't we, when we're interested in an art form, that there's a new door that gets opened.
But it was that attention to detail and that granular building slowly, 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 that eventually opened the door for you in a way that those people who were playing faster and louder and higher, quicker, didn't have.
I was really lucky to have the right mentors at the right time. The art form of the trumpet is this odd... You know, it's often people think of it like a sport because it is physically very demanding. But I tend to try to think of it more like being a ballet dancer, that you need to do this immense amount of physical preparation and, you know, have an amazingly precise technique. But once you've got all those things, that's where you begin rather than that's the means to the end. So that's when it becomes interesting. Then it becomes a vehicle of expression, as I was saying. You know, it becomes a sort of more serious art form where you can express yourself through your instrument without getting too stuck in the physical demands of it. And so I think it's a question of your attitude and your approach to it as much as anything.
Sam, do you miss the boy wonder?
Yeah, I think there are things about it I miss. I love the discovery of things. You know, I love the fact that everything was new and everything seemed possible. And I think it's sometimes the case that you achieve a kind of perfect state early on when you know no failure. You know you can't imagine how things could not work. And it's often the case that some of your early work is, and certainly I felt this with movies for me, that my early work was very good. And then it takes a long time for you to find that confidence again, because you go out there in the world and suddenly it's a bruising place and you try things and they don't work so well. And you start doubting and second guessing and all those sorts of things. And then you, if you're lucky and you retain some degree of humility, you work your way back to that place again where you have the confidence. I mean, it's interesting what Ali says about not feeling the right to call herself a soloist until the last night of the prompts. So, okay, I there's no way back now. I have to call myself and I can mean it now. And with movies, I felt that I didn't feel 100% that I was a movie director until I did Skyfall, which was about maybe over 10 years after I'd started directing movies. I always had a sort of vague embarrassment about saying action. It always felt like such a cliche, you know. But movie directors go, action, you know what I mean? It's like, how do you say it? And it just sounded like I was impersonating somebody who was a movie director, you know. And
didn't you forget to say cut in your first ever take?
I forgot. I did. Well, I mean, it's a story I've told many times, you know, but I didn't know when to say action, even when I started. It was the day before I said to the great cinematographer Conrad Hall, you know, when do I... You know, this is embarrassing, but when do I actually, so when's the moment I say action? And he said, oh, right, okay. He laughed because he was a delightful man. And I think that one of the things I found over the years is that if you admit ignorance and you ask for people's help, they're more than willing to give it to you. It's when you pretend knowledge that you get into real trouble. And he said, well, you know, I say, you know, you'll hear sound, say rolling, and you know, I'll say set on camera and then you can say action. And the first shot, the first scene, you know, action. And then everyone started doing stuff and it was great. And I thought, my God, I'm here in LA, in Hollywood, and I've said action on a movie, you know. And then they did the scene, and I was still thinking about, wow, I just said action. And then they looked at me, and I was like, why are they all looking at me? And Conrad leaned over and said, now you say cut. Cut like this with great confidence. Bravado, you know. So it's funny. I find that it comes in cycles, that you go through times of feeling great freedom. I mean, it's one of the things that I find fascinating about, you know, there are great dissimilarities about what Ali and I do, and then there are great similarities. And one of the things I've learned being with Ali and watching her is that, you know, the sort of flow state that you get into as a musician, or she gets into when she's flying and she's sort of concentrating but not thinking. I think that's how you do great concentration but no thought, which is also, I suppose, what an actor and any live performer is seeking for, is also something that I've found that I'm able to achieve in certain rehearsal situations if the circumstances are right. But it's not always under my control. You know, I need a lot of people to be aligned with me. And I'm what I am now is much more brazen about asking for that from the actors and much less worried about being prescriptive. You know, this is what I want. And I find that, you know, with age and wisdom and people look at, oh, he's done all those things, so maybe he, you know, we should probably follow what he's suggesting, makes it very easy. That's the bit I hated about being young. Yes, it was full of discovery, but I was constantly having to prove to people who were older than myself and infinitely wiser that I did know what I was doing. And in the end, the only way you can do that is just by trial and error. You know, the problem with being a director is you don't have a certificate to say you're a director. There's no one out there. You know, if you're a doctor, you know, you put your, you know, you look at his certificate, right? Okay, fine, I'll put my life in the hands of this, or put my legal affairs in the hands of this lawyer. But an actor will walk in and go, yeah, this guy seems like just a total shyster. I'll put my life in his hands for the next 5 months. You know, you can't prove it. The only way you can do it, as Peter Brook famously said, is call yourself a director and then prove to everybody that that is in fact the case. And so you're constantly proving that you know what you're talking about. And sometimes, you know, guess what? You don't, you know. And so you go through this bizarre ritual of, like you talk about Judi Dench, and I stood there, presumably, I can remember very little about it, on the first day of rehearsals for The Cherry Orchard, you know, Chekhov's masterpiece, age 24, facing a room of Judi Dench, Ronnie Pickup, Michael Goff, Leslie Manville, you know, et cetera, et cetera, and told them about The Cherry Orchard, you know, and I shudder to think what I would have said. But I was absolutely convinced, I know that, I was convinced in the moment that I had something to say, you know, but it was always that feeling that I was having to sort of be a good boy for the grown-ups, you know, just trying, you know, just try to be credible, just try to be believed, and just pray. So, yeah, that's where I was for a few years.
Can you ever admit in the artistic process that you don't know?
Yeah, well, you can in theatre, and that's one of the great joys of the theatre. You admit that pretty much every day. If your rehearsal process is any good, it can start. The best day's rehearsal you have can start with, I don't know, let's all work it out. Let's try together to work out the answer to this question. Can be a very wonderful way to open the door. In movies, no, you have to say, I know the answer, even if you don't. Because if you say for a second, you're not talking to a room of artists, you're talking to a room of 10% artists and 90% craftspeople. If you say, I don't know, they're like, well, what are we doing here then? Because if you don't know, there's no one around to tell us what the fuck to do today. So you have to know. And then you could always adjust, or you could admit you've made a mistake. Difficult on a movie set, but you can do it. And I have done that occasionally. It doesn't always go down well, but you know. But no, in theatre, I think that the admission of doubt is one of the great things about the art form. You know, you can say, I don't know, or more often than not, I think that works, but I have a feeling, a gut feeling, there's something else, different, deeper, more resonant, beyond what we've just done.
Right.
It's a sixth sense, or it's a dog whistle. You can sense there's something beyond that. How are we going to find that? Am I right? Does anyone else sense that? You know, and then you can open the door to a wonderful creative process that is, as I was trying to articulate, I mean, I've just done a play which is on still in the West End, The Motive in the Queue, which is about rehearsing a classic play, and that you get that wonderful experience where ideas happen in the space between people, where you have 10 people in a room and you have a collective idea, and every person who leaves the room at the end of that day's rehearsal feels that they've had that idea themselves, and none of you have, but somehow you created this energy which collectively creates within it and a circle. Ali said something, again, which I, you know, I've gone on about to the point where she's rolled her eyes, which is not unusual in our relationship, where she said she talked about a chord, a perfect chord, the creation of a chord. And forgive me, because this is layman's terms, but when everyone plays the chord, when everyone plays their note perfectly, a fifth, let's say it's a four notes in the chord, a fifth note appears that no one is playing, which is the overtone. That is what you seek in all art, collective art. When in the theatre, that's what you're looking for. You're looking for four people doing something so perfectly together that something else appears, which is 2 + 2 = 5, you know. And that's the thing that theatre can give you that very few other art forms can. And it's the thing that once you've had is very intoxicating, and it's a drug, and it's what you constantly wanting more of.
I disagree with that.
Excellent. Could you possibly give us an eye roll at the same time? There we go.
I don't think that is exclusive to the theatre. I mean, that's exactly what happens in classical music. You're putting all these incredible
artists. I'm stealing the music analogy.
Trying to make this analogy. But it's a good one, because you are putting these players together in a room in order to create something else, which is magic. You know, that's something I felt on this recent recording with Trevor Pinnock, a harpsichordist and director. He's able to, as you were saying, feel. It's not a verbal art form, so it's not necessarily in words, but it's something that you feel and it just resonates, that it's not quite as good as it could be. And it's just something you can't even put your finger on, but it is a case of the dark magic of putting together the right people with the right intention creates this whole other thing that you will never have if you haven't sort of risk, everyone sort of risks everything, and you come together in this way. I think it's very, very much a parallel in a live classical music.
It's also interesting because, you know, Ali will just recorded an incredible album, and, you know, I listened to it at various stages. You know, she's producing it, she's very meticulous and very, you know, testing, and her ear is extraordinary and way in advance of mine, because also she knows the music so well and I don't. But there was a piece the other day that she played, and I, to me, which is an Albinoni piece, and I thought it was beautiful, and I said so. And she said, it's not right. And I said, well, what? And she tried to describe the problem with it. I understand what she meant, but I couldn't see that it was absent from what I was listening to. And then she went away and worked on it. And then she brought it back a week later, and it completely slayed me. It was totally different. I couldn't tell you why. I couldn't tell you what she'd done particularly, but it was exquisite and quite different. You know, if there's a sort of similarity, she sometimes, I think, has that feeling. Previews of a play, she'll come to the first preview or the dress rehearsal, and then she'll see the first night and she'll be, what have you done? What's happened? You know, what has changed? Everything's changed, but nothing's changed. Mm. You know, that feeling that you're watching someone moving invisible pieces, you know, that reform the picture. So it feels totally different, even though it looks the same. But that's a great similarity between music and theatre, I think.
Ali, what about uncertainty and not knowing in your world? What about that thing of, you, that Sam says you can allow in the rehearsal room, where it's productive sometimes not to know?
No, that doesn't really apply. And that became really apparent to me when I did a project at Shakespeare's Globe, which was 10 years ago now. And it was with the English Concert and with the full company of actors at the Globe at the time, who were also doing The Tempest. And we are so used to turning up on the first day of rehearsal. We often don't have very much rehearsal. Rehearsal might be, you're lucky if you've got, you know, 2 days before the gig, as opposed to sort of 6 weeks or whatever. But we absolutely are at match fitness at the beginning of the first rehearsal. And then the conductor or the, you know, whoever's leading that those rehearsals might be able to get a bit more juice out of it. And then you add the adrenaline of the live performance and then you've got your thing. But the actors, it wasn't like that on that first day. Right. And the orchestra was so discombobulated by that. And I remember, you know, saying, having seen the actors work and the fact they were turning up and they really turned up, like, I'm just here with great attitude and I know which part I'm playing, but that's it. You know, I'm here to now learn it and now form something that doesn't yet exist. And it was so strange for the musicians. I sort of had to say to one or two of them, we're not performing this tomorrow. It's okay. You know, we can be vulnerable. The orchestra found that very uncomfortable, actually. It was a really difficult project to get going initially because it was taking all of these fantastic artists, both musicians and actors, completely out of their comfort zones and what they were used to in the theatre or in the concert hall, taking them into other places, you know, asking the orchestra to move and play from memory, asking the actors to learn complicated music that, you know, they were all musically minded, but, you know, this was something completely different. There was a lot of pushback when I was trying to launch this project, but then afterwards there was also a lot of people who said that actually changed my life because it was so different and such a sort of zooming out, you know, real perspective on what it is to be on the stage and what you're really doing there. There's a very, very, I find musicians and actors very different and actors so open and so ready to go in a journey, you know, on a journey they've never been on before. Whereas musicians, the precision and the accuracy and the technical proficiency that is expected, it's very easy for that to put walls up and make you feel like you have to stay in your lane. Otherwise, it's going to be too upsetting. A remarkable exception to that is this relatively new orchestra called Aurora Orchestra, who some of you may know. They sometimes, the whole orchestra plays from memory. Incredibly, they just played Stravinsky's Rite of Spring at the Proms last year, which was really one of the best concerts I've been to in my life because it's the whole orchestra taking away the visual aspect of a performance and just purely presenting it like it's a theatre piece, even though it's, you know, it's oral art form. And, you know, it's abstract. There's no literal story. And it's just, it's a really, really exciting place to be when you make it a little uncomfortable in that way.
Well, that takes me on to a question about mistakes. I mean, there must be some mistakes. I mean, I know you say you come to the first rehearsal sort of word perfect, as it were, musically. Presumably, under the pressure of live performance, mistakes happen.
You can't hide when you play the trumpet. Everybody knows when the trumpet player makes a mistake.
Right.
Yeah, and I actually have a recording. I need to find it because it's really funny and brilliant and, again, gives me perspective, which is when I was playing a oboe concerto by Marcello on the piccolo trumpet in Germany and was recorded and it was a great performance. The orchestra were fantastic. It was a festival. Everyone's packed in. And it was going really well and it actually went really well. And I got to the last like four or five bars thinking, yeah, I've got this. Home and dry. Just I'm nearly at the end. So I may as well just, you know, I don't know what happened in my head. Relaxed a tiny bit or something or thought, yeah, that went well or something. And I made the most spectacular mess up and but it was so bad. It was funny. It was just so like I just had my brain just fogged over and at the end, and then I managed to get back in for like the last couple of notes, but the audience were like clapping and laughing like we were all together like, how can you do so well and then so badly? and so since then, and I mean that was good 20 odd years ago, I don't think I ever do a concert and don't think about something like that. I never relax for a second till I finish the encore and I'm off the stage because, you know, even when I've switched off just before I've walked off the stage, you know, I'll fall over. I've never fallen over, but, you know, I'll trip on my dress or something will happen if I just go, oh, I have got this. And so I would never allow myself that luxury. It doesn't mean I'm not enjoying it, but I would never just sort of switch off because that's a dangerous thing.
Human moments of connection are kind of intensely thrilling.
I'm
sure that audience who heard that bum note will never forget it.
It wasn't one bum note. It was
like
a whole same
thing. Like about 10.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Collapse.
But even so.
I mean, thanks, darling.
Sam and I have already talked for this podcast. And if you're interested, go back and check out that episode of the podcast because it's sort of amazing the insights he gives. And one of the things we talked about in that conversation was order versus chaos and the sense that it's a director's job in some way to impose that order on the chaos of a bunch of different people, whether it's in film or on stage. and give it direction, give it focus, and frame our attention. But you did say that only latterly, often because of working with Jess Butterworth, who's also a play that you've got running in the West End at the moment, brilliant Hills of California by Jess, you directed The Ferryman, where he's almost consciously planting agents of chaos in his plays, like a fire, the beginning of The Ferryman, where an audience is feeling like, wait, is this a real fire on stage? Or is this a part of the action? Shouldn't someone put it out? And eventually they do. Or a rabbit in one of the characters' pockets that you've described peeing all over the apples that were then meant to be given to the children as glistening apples.
Yes.
They were supposed to look happy to be getting
they love those apples, exactly.
Urinated apples. So you talked about, tell me if I'm wrong about this, but you talked about that being a very constructive idea, a very liberating idea.
I think I was always very frightened of mistakes. And I think it, you know, you are powerless as a director. But the first thing to say as a director, you're nothing without actors, right? So actors are everything, everything. They're your friends, they're your weapons, your tools, but you are not the primary creative voice in the theatre as a director. However experienced you may be, it's an actor's medium. And you have to embrace that, you have to respect it, and you have to celebrate it. And I love most actors I've worked with, and I love working with actors. It's been very rewarding for me. But, you know, trying to stop them make mistakes was always, you know, I remember saying to Judi Dench, had directed shortly before we worked together for the first time. She had just directed her first production. She directed, and her only production, I think, to this date, a production of Much Ado About Nothing with Kenneth Branagh. Yeah. And I said, how was it? And she said, it was awful, darling, absolutely awful. She said, it's like giving birth to a blind baby and watching it walk towards the edge of a cliff. She said. And I was like, that's the best description of the pain of directing. Because, you know, you do a first preview particularly, you're like, you know, what are you doing? No, don't do that. Oh, no. Like, you know, you're in a state of absolute, you know, you're on the edge of your seat. And it's really just about not making mistakes. But Ali said something really, was very eye-opening. One of the first things she said about her when we first met about the way that she performed is that she sometimes wanted, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, to make a mistake early on. Not a huge mistake.
I don't need to make a mistake, but more just like have a moment, you know, when your blood runs cold or you think, oh, what's happening? And everyone sort of switches on.
But you also talked about how, oh, I've got it out of the way. The search for the perfect performance is off the plate now.
Right.
Now I can just relax and go for it, which I thought was a really brilliant way of describing it. It's like, in a way, it's almost like, good, that stopped me worrying. Because the tension that rises in a classical musician as the performance goes on. I remember, and anyone who's played Hamlet will say, I got it right maybe twice. Do you know what I mean? Like I would say right. I mean, I felt like everything fell into place. I remember Anton Lesser, who played it for Jonathan Miller, saying that to me twice. He said, I played 100 times. I got it twice, he said. But I got it twice, you know? And that's not never, you know? I got Hamlet twice. That's an amazing achievement. And there's something about that, the embracing the mistake, the relaxation of the mistake, opening the door to freedom is a very powerful idea. And that's one of the things that I think I enjoyed with Jazz, because it's almost impossible. You're bringing babies on stage, you're bringing rabbits, geese, you know, the geese shout on the floor, the baby cried or, you know, shat on the floor. Or, you know, and this is in The Ferryman. And the play just bent with it. It was the life force was part of what the play was about. The impossibility to contain, deny the life force in a play about death and how it was about a person who died years before, but they had not acknowledged his death. The IRA had pretended he was still alive. You know, the impossibility of holding back the life force was part of what the play was about. So I did learn a lot on that play, but I've also learned that just because life teaches you that, kids teach you that, you know, the mess of life, the impossibility of things ever going exactly as you plan. That's partly what drama is about, good drama. And you have to open your arms to that stuff. And that theatre can do. I mean, it's weird, isn't it? If you think about it, you know, Ali talks about coming prepared. Well, they have to come prepared because they do it once. I mean, it's crazy. Maybe twice, maybe three times if they're really, it's a big one. And, you know, often I find myself, now I read all the classical music reviews because I'm part of Ali's world in a peripheral sense. And I thought, well, I'd like to see that. And I was like, I can't. It's happened. You know, it's a total, you know, it's a trick. You know, you read these reviews in the Times, the Guardian, wherever,
It's like, well, that's all very well, say it's five-star review, but I missed the fucking thing. You know what I mean? It's like, what, you know, you're just gloating now. You know what I mean? You're just deliberately rubbing my nose in the fact that I'm never going to see the Rite of Spring, you know, prom. Although, hand on heart, I did. Ali said, you must come and see this Rite of Spring. It's going to be the greatest concert ever. And I didn't. And it was the greatest concert ever. So that was my own fault.
It's also not just about the mess or the mistake. It's also about the courage, you know, the positive side of that, which is the courage of doing the thing that you're expected to do, but then also finding that extra, you know, take, like Jez, writing something that's harder than the average play, you know, with the baby or whatever. Doing something that's not taking the easy option, basically. Doing something with courage, you know, like doing your ornamentation. Just like, there's an amazing pianist called Robert Levin who improvises his Mozart cadenzas, because that's what would have happened at the time of those Mozart concertos. And it's just so thrilling, because he's the courage that you bring to the stage under pressure. There's nothing that feels more like life force than not taking the easy option. Mm. I was doing something the other day. I was performing, and I know that the organisation wanted me to make the thing shorter. And I got to this really tricky part, and something I was playing, it was completely solo. And I thought, I could do what they want at this point. It would work really well just to jump this really hard next bit and make the thing shorter, do the easy thing. And I just thought, I can't do that, because I have this kind of thing that happens to me on stage where it's like, no, take the difficult option. I sometimes use alternative fingerings when I'm doing something fast for an intonation thing, knowing that it's more dangerous, because I feel like if it comes off, it's going to feel more electric than if I just get it right.
Are you in that case a kind of danger? Is the life of an artist kind of force you to be a danger junkie? Yes.
I don't think you could be a trumpet soloist if you didn't have a bit of that, because
right.
It's too risky.
Right.
It's so easy that it could go wrong.
Well, let's talk about anxiety. I mean, knowing that you are going back again to that high wire, and I've seen those, immersing myself in countless YouTube videos in the last fortnight, it's so glorious seeing you blow that thing all over the world. And your walks to the stage, the little hand kiss from the conductor, this wonderful sort of ceremony of the whole thing. And then the moment when you have to make the sound, the first sound. It strikes me as sort of, I mean, part of, apropos what we've just been talking about, I think part of inbuilt to the live experience.
Sick, yeah, I might have to get some. Me too. I don't want to think about it too
me
much.
Me too. Let's move on. You know, part of the inbuilt, I think, excitement, right, part of the reason we go to live performance is the vague sense that something could go wrong.
Again.
It'll be extraordinary if it doesn't, but it will also be extraordinary if it does. And it's intensely memorable. But tell me, how do you deal with anxiety?
It's entirely to do with the material. I find it really difficult if I don't truly believe in the piece I'm playing. I can't get into, I guess, this, as we mentioned earlier, the state of flow very easily. Whereas if I just think, that's the great thing about being a classical musician, no one's questioning the quality of the material.
Right.
It's masterful. If you don't make it sound masterful, that's your fault. But there are, you know, some pieces are better than others, or you might have an affinity with one type of music more than another. But if I believe in the piece enough, and I feel like I'm just a sort of electrical conductor, you know, from the composer to the audience, and it's like, you need to hear this the best it can be because it's so good. I don't want to get in the way. That really helps me a lot.
That calms anxiety.
And it's not really a question of anxiety. It's a question of focus,
right,
and trying to get into the place where you're not thinking about anything other than the piece of music. Calming that, you know, that little voice on your shoulders just got to go away. And that's why it's quite interesting that if I occasionally, you know, saying the two Hamlets, the occasional times when I've really truly felt in a sense of state of flow and not even thought this is going well because I'm too busy doing the thing, if I then have to play an encore and announce it, even very straightforward few words of, ladies and gentlemen, now I'm going to play this piece, it's almost impossible for me to articulate words because I've gone so... I mean, I'm not at home. I'm not practicing at home, because sometimes when you're practicing at home, you can go into this state of flow, but it's not the same at all, because I find myself on the stage and I have to reach so deep within myself to find my verbal part of my brain. And it's the oddest sensation, and it never happens to me in any other situation. But I think that's a real proof that it's these very different parts of your being that you're accessing when it's going well.
You have to reach deep into your brain to find the verbal.
To find talking. To talk to an audience, to be normal, you know, to get into the prefrontal cortex.
Oh, I see. Don't you have a recurring dream
I don't have that dream anymore, but I did.
You do? Interesting.
Yeah.
You had a dream where you were.
Yeah, no, I used to have this dream that I was on a 2 foot square paving slab, standing. It was just, I don't think I was playing the trumpet, I think I was just standing on it. This thing I was standing on was actually a column that was like a mile high. So it was, nothing changed apart from the, you know, the perception of don't move or mess this up because you'll die. Whereas it was, yeah, I had that sort of variations on that dream for a while.
So. Is it meeting Sam Mendes that made you stop having that dream?
I think it's just having kids and being so knackered.
I've got no time. Got no time for that dream anymore.
Yeah. Don't bother me. There's no point reaching for the romance.
Just before that comes.
Sam, I'm always so, you know, so curious about your relationship to anxiety or fear or nervousness of some sort. Just because, you know, the received wisdom about you, the mythos of Sam, is that you are this nerveless creature and were from sort of this ridiculous get-go. But where do you think anxiety in relationship to your work exists inside you?
Oh, I think it's there all the time. I mean, I think the reality is it just gets buried. I think I'm one of those people who takes it as a responsibility to not demonstrate my anxiety because my job is to help, to relax, to focus, and to take that off other people. So, you know, to take the weight of anxiety off people's shoulders.
And you've got very broad shoulders in that regard.
Yeah, I can do it, but it has a cost, you know. I find it's knackering because you have to, you know, in a way it's a front. But you're also filtering yourself constantly because if you say, like anyone, when you're working with other people, if you say exactly what you're thinking to the person, it would be very destructive because sometimes it's very critical. And your job is always to find a way to frame it that is achievable and positive and fundamentally trusting. You know, I do, on the whole, trust my actors, and I'm very good at that thing I think a director has to become good at, which is kind of believing in them absolutely until it's the work is done. And sometimes I come back 2 or 3 weeks later and I see it with greater clarity where the weak spots are because, you know, where you've had to believe absolutely in the ability of every performer to do exactly everything you require of them and everything the play requires of them. And, you know, it'll come out little things. I mean, you know, I tell the story about, I think Roger is here, Roger Wingate is here, but the day that I discovered that I wanted to go to try and persuade Roger, who then owned the Donmar, to let me run it. It was a building site at that point. And I was only walked past the Donmar on that particular night, which was because it was the first night of that production of The Cherry Orchard with Judi Dench. And because I was so nervous, I couldn't sit in the auditorium. And Ali will tell you, I don't watch first nights. I still find it profoundly disturbing because you watch, you know, a bunch of people writing in notebooks and stuff, and it's very, you know, you feel very vulnerable, you know, and so you just think, well, I'm just not going to watch. It's easier that my seat is taken by someone who's actually going to enjoy this as opposed to someone who's basically a nervous wreck. And I think the world is divided not into people who are nervous and not nervous, but people who show their nerves and don't. And I think I just don't. And I think I realized that. I think I might 20 years ago have said, actually, no, I'm not a nervous type. I just don't. But I, of course I am. There are some plays that I get more nervous at than others that somehow, you know, we come back to jazz, but both the jazz's plays that I worked on, The Ferryman and Hills of California, they have such a kind of, they're such a world, a complete world, that I feel that when something goes wrong, it's fine. The play can catch people. It's an odd feeling. You sometimes feel that with Chekhov. You know, it's such a complete world that if something goes wrong, you know, there was one memorable evening when Simon Russell Beale playing Uncle Vanya at the Donmar. For some reason, we got into a little spat, which is rare for Simon and I because we'd worked together over 10 times, I think, about the fact that I wanted Vanya at the very beginning of the play to be much more wired and frustrated and to bring on all the history of the previous 2 weeks with him and his frustration with what's happening in the house. And he insisted on playing the first scene sitting down. I said, you just got to get up. You just have to, you know, and we had a little set, we rehearsed it, and it was, you know, he suddenly sprung up from his chair and he nailed it. I thought it was great, fantastic, let's do that. And we came to this moment and I thought, and everyone was like, is it okay? I was like, yeah, it's going to be great tonight. It's going to be fantastic. Got to this moment, he was sitting down again. I was like, for fuck's sake. So I was in the back row and I can't fucking believe it. And then I saw him trying to get up and sit down again. And then what had happened, what had transpired is that he was wearing these boots and the laces had tied feet together. And so I'm sorry this is on radio, but for those who have the pleasure, this is his exit from the scene. It's like
Sam is jumping.
That's how he got off stage.
His feet together, yes. Like a man who has shoelaces,
like a chubby Jack in the Box. that is how he exited. Yes, and then the next night he was fine.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
All right, that's lights down on Act One of my epic chat with Sir Sam and Lady Ellie of Primrose. Please do come back and join me for the second part of my conversation with these two amazing people. And hear them discuss what it's like for Sam to have been everyone's dad professionally since he was 24, 2.5 years after his first job sweeping the stage. Just don't try taking his last sausage roll. Being a woman in a predominantly male art form, changing the paradigm of the trumpet for a worldwide audience of girls and young women. The spirituality of playing music in church, Sam's transformative memory of Jackson Pollock in Venice, the joy of throwing paint where emotion lives in their work, the trumpet piece that reflects who you are at any stage of your life whenever you play it, being uningratiating on stage, why Sam was in a kind of dream state when he was directing his new play in the West End, Hills of California by Jez Butterworth, and what auditioning newborn babies taught him about performers. It's just a great chat. Come back for the second half. I hope you do.
Stage door Johnny. Not a lot of rhymes with Johnny, but here it is. Stage door Johnny. Stage door Johnny. He sits in the balcony. Sees plays sad and funny. That's stage door Johnny. Stage door Johnny. He knows that there's no money. Being stage door Johnny. Stage door Johnny.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.